Our next guest is the smartest man in the world.
Maybe the universe.
He is so smart that he is the only guy that understands the string theory and why a knuckleball knuckles.
His name is Grinspoon, but we'll call him Dr. David Grinspoon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
Now, a brief introduction. David Grinspoon is an author of books about Venus, author about some of the loneliest planets in our galaxy, and an author of a book yet to be released. Right?
Well, of course.
What's the new one going to be about?
It's going to be about the climate, of course, but from a cosmic perspective. Like, what happens when there's global warming on other planets where there's intelligent aliens, and what do they do about it, and are they still around?
Some people might say that Al Gore already has a cosmic perspective.
Well, exactly. So we're just going to build on that.
Okay. And Dr. Grinspoon is also an astrobiologist at, you're at like some big shot Colorado museum, right?
Yeah, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. It's basically the biggest museum in between Chicago and L.A. It's a cool place. If you're in Denver, you should come check it out.
Next time you're in Denver, go to the museum there and they'll call security.
Yeah.
Okay. And we've had David on the show from time to time because he can answer any question about any planet or any astronomical situation that there is. This guy is the next Carl Sagan. So if you want to call in and ask a question of a real-life astrobiologist who knows more about space and all the rest of us put together, call 513-749-1444, and we'll take your calls with Dr. David Grinspoon, NASA astronomer, works on some of the space probe missions and all this. This guy knew Carl Sagan and everything else. 513-749-1444. Let's start with today's news.
Well, first of all, before we get to today's news, Chris, remember we had that question from the instant feedback fax machine from a Rocky in Hamilton. He wanted to know, Dr. Grinspoon, please explain the difference between the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe, if you can.
Oh, sure. The universe, let's start big and work small. The universe is basically everything there is, sort of by definition.
Now, hold on a minute. I would disagree with you.
Here we go.
There's more to the universe than just everything.
Well.
Right? 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 You know I'm right.
There's more to everything than just the universe, I would say.
Right.
There's more to the universe than everything.
This is a cosmic conundrum that goes back before Einstein. They were thinking about this.
The other way around, there's more to everything than just the universe because now people talk about a polyverse where there might be multiple universes.
What about this whole thing about every universe is a bubble and that's like soap bubbles? Explain to us the whole soap bubble universe theory.
Well, the soap bubble universe theory, of course, it helps if you've just swallowed a whole bunch of acid. That's the only way to really understand it. But if you haven't, then it's basically just a cosmological solution to Einstein's equations of general relativity. You know, if you plug in those numbers, you get some very weird solutions where you get these strange geometries, and they don't really make any sort of rational sense. So people use these kind of analogies like soap bubbles and strings and membranes and stuff, but it's not really my area. I'm not a cosmetologist.
I thought you were gonna say you're not an acid head.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but the universe is everything. We can leave it at that, and then watch the the galaxy.
No, we can't leave it at that. All right, but we'll move on.
This is a mainstream general discussion. This isn't.
This is a controversial topic.
This isn't some dorm room around some Darth Vader bomb.
We don't want to mislead our listeners into thinking that the universe is everything when it's not. It's more than everything.
Dude, the wall is not playing in the background. The RA is not going to knock on the door.
One of these terms, that like people basically use to encompass the largest grouping of everything you can see or you can imagine. But when you get into galaxy and solar system,
okay, what's a galaxy?
Much more specific meaning. You know, the solar system is basically our sun and everything that's orbiting around it, which includes the planets, a bunch of comets, a bunch of asteroids. That's basically it.
Now, David, I'll agree with you on that
It means a lot to him that you're agreeing with him.
Everything that surrounds the solar system is everything in the solar system. I'll agree with you on that.
Exactly. Everything in the solar system is in the solar system. And not only that, it's the sun and everything in orbit around it.
Now,
the solar system seems huge to us because, you know, the Earth is big and the planets are far away and the sun's far away. But if you think of the galaxy, our galaxy, our solar system is a tiny part of that because our sun is one star out of hundreds of billions in our galaxy, you know, about 300 billion stars in our galaxy. So take our solar system and then imagine 300 billion of those spread far and wide in space in a sort of disc-shaped assemblage. In fact, our galaxy is also known as the Milky Way, and when you look in the sky in a dark place and you see that sort of bright band across the sky, you're basically seeing the disc that we are in the edge of. You're seeing it edge on, and that's our galaxy. Now, that seems huge, hundreds of billions of stars, but that's just one galaxy, and then our universe, which is all the galaxies that we know about and are fairly certain all the galaxies that there are, is hundreds of billions of galaxies in that universe. So you sort of have this hierarchy where we have our planet, and then we have our solar system, and then our solar system exists within this one galaxy, the Milky Way, which then exists within a cluster of galaxies we call the local group, and then the local supergroup, you know, which is not the same thing as, like, Stephen Stills and Mike Bloomfield. It's a supergroup of galaxies. And then beyond that, you basically have the structure of the entire universe that we know of. So it's this sort of hierarchy of structures nested within other structures.
Now, while we're talking about things on a large scale, let me ask you a very important point here. If we're talking about these structures of the universe, then the galaxies, then the solar systems, and all these groups, and how things are structured on a large scale, are particles structured the same way at a subatomic level?
Well, that's an interesting idea, you know, and a lot of philosophers have talked about that possibility over the years, that nested structure can keep going inside, and that maybe, you know, the atoms that we are made out of are like little solar systems, and then they're made out of atoms that are even like littler solar systems.
Or like little universes.
Like little universes. And in a general sense, in a way, that's true. If you look at the structure of matter on smaller scales, the matter that we are made out of, you know, there are groupings of, you know, atoms are made out of these subatomic particles, like electrons, protons, neutrons, and then those turn out to be made out of smaller particles like quarks and so forth. And, you know, you can imagine that it sort of goes on forever, but according to the people that work out the, you know, particle physics and the particles and the forces that sort of hold all matter together, they don't think that it goes on forever. They think that there's sort of an ultimate small scale, which is something they call the Planck length, which is something, you know, like a ridiculously small, like 10 to the minus 40th, or, you know, 0.00000 with 40 zeros, one, as small as, the sort of scales that we can see and that we're used to, but it doesn't go on forever. They claim that there is a smallest possible scale based on the laws of quantum mechanics.
Well, then how large can you get?
We're getting kind of far afield from space science here.
I know, we're going to get to it, but Rob started all this about the universes and the galaxies.
By asking about the universe and the galaxy, I said, please discuss particle physics. That's what you're accusing me of.
Now, do we know what's outside the universe? I mean, how far does the universe actually go?
Well, it's interesting because recent instruments like the Hubble Space Telescope, we can apparently see as far away as you can see, meaning that you got to remember the farther away you look, and this is kind of a weird concept, but the farther away you look, the farther back in time you're looking.
Time is relative, though. It's the fourth dimension. We can travel through time once we master the technology.
Well, maybe. But the thing is, because of the speed of light, as far as we know, is finite, if you're looking 10 light years away, then you're looking 10 years back in time. That light you're seeing left that star 10 years ago. If you're looking a million light years away, you're looking a million years back in time. So the we think we can see galaxies that are basically about 12 billion light years away and that seem to be basically forming as new galaxies out of the primordial substance of the universe. And as far as we can tell, the universe is about 12 billion years old. So that would mean that that in a certain sense, the size of the universe is also about, you know, roughly speaking, 12 billion light years. So if we're right about all this, and, you know, I give us maybe 50-50 chance of being right about cosmology at this point in our history, but if the cosmologists are right about all this, then we actually can say how big the universe is.
Okay, here's my last comment on these cosmological points, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty. There's no way. 12 billion sounds like a big number, but to me, that sounds way too young. The universe is too big, and there's too much stuff going on for all this to only be 12 billion years old.
Well,
we can comprehend 12 billion as a number. I'm thinking that universe out there has got to be at an age of a number that we can't really comprehend as normal people.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it's not that easy to comprehend 12 billion, but, I mean, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and that's pretty well established. And so that means that the universe is only, you know, about three times as old as the Earth.
Yeah, there's no way, bro. There's no way. The universe has to be at least three times that old, if not like hundreds of billions of years old.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right.
Write that down, and someday when some scientist with a degree discovers that, I want you to say, no, wait a minute. This guy in Cincinnati said it first.
Yeah, we'll name a principle after you.
Okay, this is the Chris and Rob Show. Our guest is Dr. David Grinspoon. What's your website there, Dr. David Grinspoon?
Funkyscience.net.
Go to funkyscience.net to find out more about Dr. David Grinspoon. And now let's get into some of these news items that there's these probes we're going to talk about, and then there's this planet we're going to talk about that's not in our solar system. And if anybody wants to call into the show and say hello to Dr. David Grinspoon and ask a legitimate question about outer space, the phone number is 513-961-8900.
On February 28th, as you probably know, Dr. Grinspoon, the New Horizons probe passed within 1.4 million miles of Jupiter as it shot towards Pluto, and while it was in the neighborhood of Judo, it said, what the heck, let's take a lot of pictures. And it did take a lot of pictures, and some of those images were unveiled today during a NASA news conference, and a lot of brand new pictures that no one outside of NASA had seen. And we were hoping that you had been able to take a look at some of these pictures. And what do you think about the new views of Jupiter from the New Horizons probe?
Well, they're really incredible. Actually, I saw the news conference today, it was pretty remarkable because, you know, New Horizons is, for people that don't know, is the spacecraft that's going to Pluto, and it was launched last January, January 06, and it's already made it as far as Jupiter and beyond, actually, now. It got to Jupiter in February, so that's basically 1 year to get to Jupiter, which is a really fast trip. It was an incredibly fast launch from Earth. I was actually at the launch, and the thing, you know, went up like a rocket, so to speak. it was really incredible, fast, loud, and furious, and it's already past Jupiter. And what happened today was that they released the results from that encounter with Jupiter and its moon last February. And you might ask, well, why have they been sitting on them all this time?
I can tell you why. There's a cover-up, bro. It's a cover-up. You know it, I know it, but our listeners are still in doubt.
I knew you were going to think that, and you know.
I know it is because I heard it on the Art Bell Show, and it's got to be true.
Yeah, and that's you know, America's finest news source, right up there with the Onion is Art Bell.
Grinspoon, whose show is better to be on? You've been on both, Art Bell's show or ours?
Well, yeah, Art Bell has longer commercial breaks, so you can get up and get a beer. But your show, in general, the quality of the conversation is much higher, so I would prefer you guys.
Thank you. And if you want to take a beer break, that's fine with me. I'll play another Bowie record.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that.
All right.
Yeah, anyway, so the data from Jupiter, it's taken a while to get it all back down to Earth. The thing about this New Horizons mission is the spacecraft is really streamlined. It's a really tiny, relatively tiny spacecraft with a big rocket, just so you can really blast the thing to Pluto so it gets there, you know, while we're hopefully still alive. It gets there in 2015 because it's a long way to Pluto. So it doesn't have a very big antenna or transmitter. So it actually took months to get the data down from Jupiter to here. So they basically just got it down and they released it. But boy, do they have some cool stuff. I think some of the most beautiful pictures of Jupiter itself I've ever seen. And also amazing pictures of the moon. There is this moon called Io, which is the most volcanically active place in our solar system. It's just, there's volcanoes blowing off all the time.
And it looks like they found yet another volcano today, because when they went there in the 70s with Voyager, they found volcanoes and plumes of smoke over the atmosphere. And it's in today's pictures, too, which means these things must be spewing all the time.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's a remarkably active place. It's the most active surface in the solar system. And, yeah, we were lucky that as New Horizons flew past Io in February, there happened to be a volcano near the North Pole that was just blown its top. It's like 200 miles out into space, this plume, and the pictures, you can just see it flying off into space. In fact, anybody listening, if you've got web access, you can see these pictures. They're on the web now. If you just Google New Horizons, and then when you get to the New Horizons website, just click on News Center, and then you can click on Press Conference Images, and they're all up there. And you can see this volcano, new pictures of Jupiter, new pictures of Jupiter's rings, and really cool pictures of Europa and some of the other moons, too. So it's really just a treasure trove. And the cool thing about Io, or Io, depending on how you want to pronounce it, there's a big raging scientific debate over whether it's Io or Io.
Oh, I bet that's fascinating.
Yeah, they got the same problem with that planet Uranus, too.
Yeah, exactly. That's a tough one. Mm-hmm. And the other cool thing about it is they have these infrared pictures of the nighttime on Io, and you can see the glowing volcanoes at night, which is really amazing. It's just a seething ball of volcanic activity and sulfur flows, and it's different every time we look at it. It's like the geology there changes like the weather on another planet.
Now, this probe New Horizons is going all the way to Pluto. Is it going to stop by Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus just like it's doing with Jupiter?
It's not. It's only going to Jupiter, and then it's going to Pluto. The thing is, it needed the Jupiter flyby, because it's not going to Jupiter primarily to look at Jupiter. It's going to Jupiter primarily to use the giant gravity of Jupiter.
Slingshot effect.
Yeah, as a boost in velocity, right, to slingshot it out towards Pluto. So it was just lucky that we got to make all these cool observations of Jupiter that were released today.
Is it going to be able to break when it gets to Pluto, or is it going to just go screaming past it?
It's a flyby. The first mission we do to a new place, a new planet, is almost always a flyby, because they're the cheapest, and it's hard to just get to somewhere. The first mission to Venus, the first mission to Mars, Jupiter, they were all flybys. It's a more difficult thing to do an orbiter, because then you have to carry another big rocket with you to fire when you get there to slow down enough to go into orbit. And then it's even harder to do a lander, because then you have to go into orbit and have another rocket with you where you can land and slow down when you get to the planet. So the easiest thing to do is just a flyby, and that's what we're doing at Pluto.
All right, I got a good question for you then. I know it's got to take some quick pictures when it goes by Pluto then. It's got to work real fast.
Right.
But it's a two-part question. So when this New Horizons, goes screaming past Pluto, did the designers of the spacecraft have a plan for it once it gets past Pluto, out into that Oort cloud, that asteroid belt, weirdo ice stuff that's out there?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and even inside the Oort cloud now, there's this area that we call the Kuiper Belt. And I think you and I have talked about that before. And Pluto is now seen as sort of the innermost object of this belt of material that we call the Kuiper Belt of all of these icy objects out there. And the plan with New Horizons is to go to one or two or maybe even three more Kuiper Belt objects after Pluto. But the weird thing is that the plan is to go to objects that we haven't discovered yet, but that we are going to discover between now and when we get to Pluto. And you can predict the chances of the probability that we will discover objects on the right orbit for New Horizons to get to them. Is pretty high, so we think we'll be able to visit some other objects, but we don't know which ones we're going to yet, because we have to discover them first.
Do you think they'll name any of them Grinspoon?
Well, I think they ought to name at least one of them.
They'll call it the Grinspoon object.
And they'll call one Chris and one Rob. I mean, there's a lot of objects out there.
Yeah, so there's even an asteroid named after Frank Zappa.
Yeah, well, there should be.
Yeah. Okay, and then here's the second part of that question. All right, so we got New Horizons is going to go screaming past Pluto. Well, back in the 70s, we sent up two of these guys called Voyager, which are pretty famous because they went by Jupiter and Saturn and all the big gas planets, and they had the record on it with the Chuck Berry and the Bach and the Beethoven. And those things went screaming out of the solar system, albeit a bit slower than this New Horizon guy is. And I know that they're still sending data back. What's up with the two Voyagers now, today?
Yeah, you know, so Voyager 1 and 2, well, first it was Pioneer 10 and 11, which was the first two man-made craft on trajectories that could leave the solar system. And then there were the Voyagers, which are on their way out of the solar system. In fact, Voyager 1 has apparently reached what some scientists consider to be the edge of the solar system, which is the magnetopause, where the sun's magnetic field sort of ends and the galactic magnetic field takes over. And so one of the Voyagers actually measured this shock wave at the edge of the sun's magnetic field, and it's heading into interstellar space.
Wow. And
so they're basically going to wander, you know, more or less forever, and eventually maybe enter some other star system where people or not people, but some kind of creatures might, who knows, might find them and decide they want to listen to the record that we sent.
And create a big cloud and come back to Earth someday, and then they'll mistake it as a V'ger.
Yeah, exactly, and V'ger demands the information.
Yeah, I'm kidding about all that, but so these are all these probes then sending back data 40 years after they were launched?
Yeah, the ones that we're still in contact with. I mean, the thing is, the Voyagers and the Pioneers aren't doing much now because they're in an area of space where there isn't very much going on. There's not that much to observe. The Pioneers are basically just monitoring the position of, and even that gives some interesting information. Just, you know, they're just transmitting a weak signal, but you can still monitor their position. You know, how gravity's affecting them out there. The Voyagers are taking some observations, they're still, of the magnetic field. They're not doing very much, but we're still in contact with them. We can still trace them and see where they are.
Okay, and are they still flying in a straight shot, or are we monitoring them in the way that you might monitor, like, a weather kite to see if there's some kind of forces at play, whether they're magnetic or radioactive or maybe even, like, a solar wind that might be blowing these things around? Are we learning anything about the environments out past the solar system by any data or trajectories that these things are flying?
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, they're monitoring the acceleration very carefully to look for any deviations from, you know, the predictions of our understanding of gravity, because there's some ideas that gravity, you know, over the long run might behave a little bit differently than we predict. So by watching their trajectories very carefully, it is sort of like a weather balloon, only, you know, it's looking at gravity in a very careful way. For another thing, they're still measuring the magnetic field out there. So, you know, looking for the shock wave at the edge of the sun's influence and you know, basically seeing what the environment is like out there. So they're not doing a lot, but they are still, you know, basically, I think a weather balloon is a good analogy. You know, they're basically, we're monitoring them very carefully to see if we can learn anything new about this realm, because after all, we haven't had any machines out there before.
Dr. Grinspoon, why are things pertaining to Jupiter called Jovian instead of Jupiterian?
Oh, man, you know, that's just linguistics, you know. It has to do with the Latin roots of words, and I'm not really an expert in it. What I can tell you is that there used to be a big fight over what things pertaining to Venus should be called, because actually Carl Sagan didn't like Venusian. He thought it was ugly sounding, so he proposed Cytherian.
What?
Cytherian.
For what? For being from Venus?
Yeah, because I guess it had to do with the Roman word for Venus.
That's ridiculous.
And he was also worried that people might use venereal and then get terribly confused, because that word is already used for other things.
What did old Mr. Sagan think about the planet Uranus?
Well, that's kind of funny, actually.
I bet it is.
No, I had a discussion with him once about that because he told me that when he was in school as a kid, that they called it Uranus because they didn't like Uranus, because it sounded too much like it had the word urine in it. And I was like, yeah, but Uranus.
That's the planet whose slogan is, you just can't win.
Exactly. You just can't win with that one.
Hey, listen, who named it that?
It's a Roman god name.
Oh, it's an ancient god.
Well, dude, how many, there are, you know, we talked about this in depth.
How many gods are there? How many Roman gods are there?
How many ridiculous Roman gods there are? Chris and I discussed this in depth at a very thoughtful discussion about this not more than 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we came to the conclusion that it was all a bunch of crap, and no one should have to learn that kind of stuff. But why didn't they pick, you know, Saturn? They did. What about a god that doesn't have, what about, I don't know,
Aphrodite?
Poseidon.
Well, but Aphrodite is another word for Venus, so that would have been confusing. But
work
yeah,
with me
I,
here.
What about?
I would tend to agree. Out of all the gods, you think they could have picked?
What about Romulus or Remus?
Yeah.
What
yeah,
about Medusa or Hercules?
I'm not going to defend this choice.
Well, dude, I mean, you know, I don't know.
Listen, we're going to take five because David Grinspoon needs to go get a beer. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick little break here. We're going to have a little record about a flying saucer. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. David Grinspoon about the Venus Express. And we're going to talk to Dr. David Grinspoon about Gliese 581 and the planet that is orbiting around Gliese. Or is it Gliese?
Gliese.
Gliese. Gliese 581.
For now, it'll probably be changed the next time these pointy heads get together.
Yeah. So stay tuned. We're going to come back with all this and more with our good friend, Dr. David Grinspoon, and your phone calls at 513-961-8900.
We interrupt this record to bring you a special bulletin. The reports of a flying saucer hovering over the city have been confirmed.
Now that Dr. Grinspoon has a fresh, cold beer in his hand, we're ready to get back to the radio show and take your phone calls if you'd like to call in and talk about all things cosmic. 513-961-8900. This is the Chris and Rob Show on WAIF, Cincinnati's Alternative FM. 513-961-8900. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, let's start off with the Venus Express.
Oh, yeah. Well, Venus Express is a mission, a spacecraft that we have in orbit around Venus right now. It's a European Space Agency mission, and it's really cool for me because I got to be one of two Americans selected to be part of the science team as interdisciplinary scientists. So even though it's a European mission, I'm on the team. I get to travel a lot to exotic European cities, but even better than that, I get to be part of this ongoing new mission to Venus and help plan observations and, you know, help interpret the data. So it's really cool because I've always wanted to be part of a Venus mission, and now I am. And stay tuned because there's going to be a lot of news coming from Venus soon for Venus Express. So we're just about to publish the first results. But
you know, this makes a lot of sense.
Here, learning about the greenhouse effect on Venus, looking for volcanoes on the surface, and you know, we're learning things every day.
You know, you're one of the world's leading experts on Venus. You did a whole book on Venus called Venus Revealed, and it seems to me that you're one of the guys who knows more about this particular planet than probably anybody else ever.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I know a bunch of people that know a lot about Venus, but I'm probably you know, it's a small club, and I'm definitely a member of it, and you know, it's something I've always been interested in. In fact, I would say that Venus is my second favorite planet.
After Earth, right?
Absolutely.
So give us a little sneak peek, a little preview, a little coming attractions. What are we going to discover here with this mission, Venus Express? What's going to rock our world about that world?
Well, one thing that we've always, or for a long time, been wondering about Venus is there's a mystery of the way its upper atmosphere is whipping around the planet. There's a thing called the super rotation that we really don't understand, where the planet rotates slowly, but the upper atmosphere, where the sulfuric acid clouds are, is rotating really, really fast.
Did everybody hear that? He said sulfuric acid clouds.
But I think with this mission, we're starting to see a lot more detail in that motion, and we've discovered some strange things, like around the north pole of the planet, there's what we're calling a double vortex. It's basically like when you drain your bathtub and it makes this kind of vortex shape. That's happening around the pole. So it seems like air is rising at the equator, sinking down at the poles in this double vortex. And, you know, I think we're going to learn a lot about how solar energy is being absorbed in the atmosphere and is driving that weird rotation. And ultimately, we're learning about the climate there, which is going to tell us about climate change on Earth and even the possibility of whether Earth will eventually have a runaway greenhouse effect like Venus. So in terms of comparative planetology, which is what I like to think about, we're getting this whole treasure trove of information where Venus is becoming a much more three-dimensional place that we can really compare to our own planet.
I thought Venus was really cold.
No. It's hot, hot, hot.
Venus is hot?
Yeah. It's almost 900 degrees on the surface there, hot enough to melt lead.
You could really make a Totino's pizza up there, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
You wouldn't even have to take it out of the box.
You could fry an egg on the sidewalk, except the sidewalk would melt before you had a chance to do that.
Yeah. So tell us about these sulfuric clouds. I mean, this sounds really terrible and evil and like hell.
Well, yeah, some people have said Venus is, you know, Earth's evil twin, although I think that's just kind of a bias because maybe there's aliens out there that love sulfuric acid. But it is kind of amazing. When you look at Venus at night, and by the way, these days Venus is really bright in the evening sky right after sunset. You should check it out in the west. You can't miss it. It's the bright thing out there in the west. The reason why it's so bright is because it's completely covered with these reflective clouds. So historically we thought, oh, Venus must be just like Earth. It's got clouds. It must be dripping wet and all full of water and kind of a nice place. But then when we started going there with spacecraft and actually seeing what those clouds were made out of, it turns out they're made out of battery acid, concentrated sulfuric acid. So it's rather an intense place.
And what sort of orbit is the Venus Express in around Venus?
You're not going to land anything, are you?
No, we want to do that in the future, send landers. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, that's a lot more expensive. And so this is just an orbiter, but it's actually in a really cool orbit. It's what we call highly elliptical polar orbit.
Quasi-polar orbit.
Yeah, which it means that it swings low over the North Pole every orbit, and then it's this big ellipse, so it goes high over the South Pole, and the orbital period is exactly 24 hours, so it's synced up with an Earth day. So once every 24 hours, the spacecraft turns away from Venus towards Earth and sends that information down to Earth. It gets received in a big antenna in Spain, and then basically the spacecraft turns back towards Venus, takes more observations, swings around Venus one more time, and then it's 24 hours later and it swings to Earth again and sends the information back. So it's basically synced to Earth with its 24-hour orbit, so we can just keep on taking more observations and then sending the information home.
Now, I think I know why you're not landing anything, and I know why it's expensive, but explain to our listening audience the history of attempted landings on the planet Venus. It seems like we have a little more success landing things on Mars.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really intense on Venus because, as I mentioned, it's almost 900 degrees. It's also really intense pressure. The atmosphere is very thick, and it's almost 100 times surface pressure on Earth. So the first few attempts at landing something on Venus were done by the Soviet Union, and a couple times they thought they had landed, but it turns out that they had just reached an altitude where the pressure was so great that their spacecraft basically imploded and stopped sending signals. So there were a lot of attempts that failed because of the harsh conditions, although the Russians eventually did succeed in landing several spacecraft on Venus, which is really quite a feat. You know, they basically, their spacecraft, if you think of like a big diving bell to go into the deep ocean, the spacecraft were like that. They were basically just these pressure vessels with a lot of insulation, and they lasted on the surface, you know, more or less about an hour before they basically melted in the heat. But they did manage to take some observations and send back the first few pictures from the surface of Venus.
And there's a very small number of pictures, like only like three or four?
Yeah, there's a few more than that, but basically there's just a handful, basically less than half a dozen, about four or five sites where they managed to land. And so we have pictures of a few of those sites because some of them, the cameras didn't work. There's a famous, there's a lot of famous failures, including the first time that they sent color pictures, they sent color cameras. They got pictures of what seemed like a brown, sticky, viscous liquid, and there were a lot of jokes about what that might be that they had landed in. But it turned out that the lens caps had melted onto the cameras, and so they were getting pictures of melted lens caps. And there's a whole history of problems like that because it's just hard to design things for that environment.
What have we learned from any pictures taken on the surface? Anything meaningful?
Oh, yeah. The most of the places that the Russians managed to land and photograph Venus, it looks like sort of old volcanic rocks. that have eroded with lots of dirt and kind of reddish orangish sky. And yeah, that's told us a lot, you know, that combined with the orbital radar images of the surface, you know, we've learned that Venus is covered with volcanic rocks of various ages, and there's, you know, some erosion there, even though there's no rainfall, and that red sky that you see from the surface, that sort of dull red sky, is because the atmosphere and the clouds are so thick that you don't have any direct sunlight hitting the surface. It's all very diffuse through the clouds. It's sort of like permanent sunset colors everywhere, and dim, diffuse, overcast light. So having those surface pictures is tremendously valuable in sort of corroborating what we know about the planet from our other observations. Even though we just have a few places on the surface, at least we have some sort of ground truth to compare to our other images from orbit and our ideas about the atmosphere. So, it's pretty important.
On the surface of Venus, would the conditions at the poles be a little different than at the equator, just like on Earth or at Mars? I mean, even Mars has ice caps, so would it be maybe a little less hot at the pole of Venus?
Actually, strangely enough, you would think so, wouldn't you? But it turns out that on the surface of Venus, the poles are the same temperature as the equator. And
it's just a big oven, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. And the night side is the same temperature as the day side, which is also strange. And the reason why is because that atmosphere is so thick that it basically redistributes heat everywhere around the planet faster than differences in sunlight can create those differences in temperature. So the thick atmosphere means that it's basically the same temperature everywhere on Venus.
We're talking to Dr. David Grinspoon, a world-famous astrobiologist. And if you would like to call in and say hello and ask some questions about the planets and the sky, the phone number here is 513-961-8900.
How does Venus's magnetic field compare to Earth's?
That's another weird thing, because Venus doesn't really have a magnetic field.
So your refrigerator magnets would all just fall off?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Earth has this intense magnetic field, and Venus is such a similar planet in terms of size and interior structure, you would expect it would have the same thing. It's probably because it's spinning very slowly, and Earth's magnetic field partly is generated, we think, by the spin of the planet and that dynamo in the core. But so what Venus has is this strange thing in the upper atmosphere called an induced magnetic field, where the solar wind, which has all these charged particles from the sun, basically hits the planet, the upper atmosphere, and charges it, and then that creates a magnetic field. So if Venus has a magnetic field in the upper atmosphere, which is induced by the sun's magnetic field, but it doesn't have an intrinsic one coming from the interior like Earth does. We're not completely sure why that is, but it goes to show how much that we really don't understand about Earth.
And doesn't Venus spin the wrong way?
It does, yeah. It spins.
How'd you know that, Rob?
Direction
I'm a big Venusian.
If you're on Venus, the sun would rise in the west and set in the east.
That could be confusing to, like, you know, romantic lovers.
It would be. You would get all mixed up because it would be sunrise, but you would think it was sunset.
Phone number here is 961-8900, and let's change topics to this other thing we wanted to get to tonight. And rather than me read this AP Wire article that came out about it, this was big news about a week ago. In fact, I think it came out 1 week ago today. A planet was discovered around a star that's not real far away. And the planet is a lot like Earth as far as we can tell. The star is called Gliese 581, which is a dumb name. And the planet is called C-581, which is an even dumber name.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like it's from, like, The Prisoner or something.
I know. Would you get, like, guys who are naming these new cars to name that or something?
Yeah. So rather than me read this press release, David, why don't you just tell us from the beginning what's up with C-581 orbiting Gliese 581?
Terrible.
Yeah, well, this is really neat. As you know, we've been discovering all these new planets in the last decade or so around other stars.
I remember when the first one was discovered, and it was like about 5 miles away from the surface of the sun that it was orbiting, and it was like three times as big as Jupiter, and it was just a big gas ball. But now they're starting to find some, like, interesting planets.
Yeah, it's easier to find the ones that are big in their orbit close to their planet, because we find these by the wobble that they make on their star. So the bigger ones make a bigger wobble. You don't actually see the planet. You see the star moving in a funny way. If it's got a big wobble, it's because there's a big planet orbiting it, tugging its gravity around. And so it's easy to find the really huge ones, and the ones that orbit in close, because they have a faster wobble, because, you know, closer planets orbit faster. So it's not surprising that the first ones we found were these, like, sort of super Jupiters that were really hot because they orbited close to their stars. But now we've been looking for about 10 years, and our techniques are getting better and better, so we can find the smaller planets that make these smaller wobbles, around, make their stars move, you know, less intensely than a giant super Jupiter. And that's cool, because now we can start to really look for planets that are a lot more like Earth. And this planet that they just found, it's not so much that it's exactly like Earth. In fact, we know its mass, we know its distance from the star. It's a fair amount larger than Earth. In fact, it's about five times the mass of the Earth. But what's really significant about it is that it seems to orbit this star in what we usually call the habitable zone, meaning the zone of distance from the star where liquid water ought to be stable. If it's too close, then it's like Venus. It's really hot. The water's all evaporated. If it's too far, then it's frozen. But this planet seems to be in that zone, like the Earth is around our sun, where liquid water could be stable on the surface in terms of the temperature that you would expect there. And that's what's exciting, because we've been expecting to start to find these kinds of planets where you could have liquid water oceans and maybe even life evolving. But this is the first one we've identified that really seems to be in that habitable zone.
Okay, let me ask you some questions about this planet C581 and see if we can't give it some perspective so that our listeners can get an idea based on some things we already know. If it's five times the size of the Earth, how many times the size of the Earth is Jupiter?
Jupiter is, Jupiter is about 100 times the mass of the Earth.
Okay, so this is not even halfway between the Earth and Jupiter. This is just a little bit bigger than Earth compared to Jupiter.
Right.
If it's that much bigger than Earth, is it rocky, or is it like some kind of gas sludge ball like Jupiter is?
Well, that's an interesting question, because we don't know what it's made out of yet. We just know the mass.
And can't you tell from that light thing where the light splits up into a little barcode?
Well, you could if we got light from it, and you could do spectroscopy, which is what you're talking about, where you actually see the light in very fine detail and then look at the different colors and figure out basically what it's made out of from the spectrum. But we haven't been able to do that with this object yet. But one thing that's cool about this is, as you mentioned, it is around a very close star. It's only 20 light years away, which makes it one of the, you know, it's in the group of the 100 closest stars to our star, to the sun. So that means that this is a place where not too far in the future we probably will be able to do spectroscopy. We'll actually be able to get some light directly from the planet and then actually make direct observations and tell what it's made out of. But for now we have to rely on models. And for an object this size at that distance from its star, there's sort of two models. One is that it's rocky like the Earth, and another is that it's more of an ice ball. Like basically a giant, picture the moons of Jupiter, these icy moons. It could be a giant ice ball. But either way, it probably has liquid water on the surface, and so that's what makes it really exciting.
Okay, if this place is 20 years light years away, it goes without saying that we could get there in 20 years if we could travel at the speed of light, which we can't yet. But I'm sure future generations will get closer to that goal. But it does mean that if it took that Voyager thing back in the 70s about 10 years to get to Jupiter, and now we can get to Jupiter in about a year with this this New Horizons, doesn't it go without saying that at that rate of advance in technology, as long as we don't nuke ourselves, that maybe not within our lifetimes, you and me, but maybe within our children's lifetimes, we can send a probe up to this Gliese 581 and take some pictures up close.
Yeah, you know, I actually do think it's possible. I mean, the thing about future technology, of course, is that it's really hard to predict. And, you know, if you look at in the past at people that tried to predict future technology, you know, for the most part, they're wrong, although some people remarkably get it right.
It's funny how the science fiction writers always seem to come close.
Well, some of them do, you know, and the thing about, you know, you mentioned the huge pace of technology development, and you're absolutely right. I tend to think that before too long, meaning some number of generations, we will be able to send probes to other stars. And I don't think now we know what the technology is that will allow us to do that, but I think that it probably is coming. And then once we can do that, then this is certainly a planet that we will be able to reach, because it's, you know, among the nearest stars. The nearest stars about 4 or 5 light years away, and this thing's only 20 light years away, so it's definitely among the nearest stars.
And pretty soon when we can tesseract, we can get there in about 45 minutes.
Oh, I can't wait for that. You know, another thing that's cool about this is that it's around a different kind of star than the sun. Our sun is what we call a G star, which is sort of an average sized yellow star. This thing is around a red dwarf, or what we call an M star, an M dwarf. And the thing about red dwarfs is that they're cooler than our sun. We used to think that there couldn't be any habitable planets around red dwarfs, but now recently people have been predicting that there could be. In fact, I'm co-author of a paper that predicted that there ought to be habitable planets around red dwarfs that came out about a month ago, and now here we are finding this thing. And what's cool about that is that there are actually a lot more red dwarfs than there are G stars. There are many more stars in the universe of this kind than there are of our sun's kind. So if there can be habitable planets around red dwarfs, that opens up a lot more real estate for possible life in the universe.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Not only that, but red dwarfs last much longer than our kind of star. Our star is going to last, 10 billion years maximum, and it's already used up half of that lifetime. But red dwarfs can last, close to 100 million years, like 60 million years or even longer. So they can last much longer. So there's a lot more time potentially for life to evolve around this kind of star. So maybe that our kind of star is sort of the backwater of the universe, and that where all the action is around these little red stars, of which there are a lot more. And Gliese 581c is just one example of what may turn out to be many habitable places in our galaxy.
You know, the action is happening here because this planet has all the bling.
Well, you can say that, but you have no idea what they're wearing on the Gliese 581c.
Which brings me to my next idea, and I want you to tell me if anyone else has come up with this idea. I'm sure somebody has, but you got these guys with the radio telescopes at Project SETI. You got Dr. Frank Drake, and you got his sidekick, Seth Shostak, and all these people with their big radio telescopes and at Movie Contact. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And I know they've been scanning the sky for radio signals from some civilization on all the different bandwidths, not just the ones we use here for AM and FM, but all the different bandwidths that you can look at and listen to and send TV or, hit records on.
Right.
And when you find not only a unique star, and I don't know if they've ever, picked out stars that were more likely to have a planet around them than others, but now that we actually have a planet, I know it was only a week ago that they announced it, but I'm sure they knew about it more than a week ago. Has anyone at Project SETI or one of these radio telescope big shots pointed one of their dishes right at Gliese 581 and scanned all the different frequencies to see if anybody up there is rocking and rolling?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think that since that discovery they have yet pointed at that star in this last week. But I do know that Gliese 581 is on one of the SETI target lists. But the thing is, how I mentioned that we didn't used to think that there could be habitable planets around these little red stars? So it used to be that in the past, we didn't target red dwarfs like this. We only targeted more sun-like stars. There's these long lists of stars that the SETI projects target, and they go from one to the next. But now, more recently, these red stars have been added to the lists. And I don't know if specifically Gliese has been listened to, but I do know that it's on a SETI target list, and I'm sure it's one of the planets that, with this new Allen telescope array that's just going online, that's going to be the best SETI instrument ever. I'm sure we will point it in the direction of this planet, and just maybe, who knows, maybe somebody will be home there and will be sending us a message.
I never heard of these Allen radio telescopes. I heard of the wrenches he invented, because I got a set of those at home.
No, not that Allen. This is Paul Allen, the Microsoft zillionaire. He has partially funded this new SETI telescope equipment that is being built in California. It's called the ATA, the Allen Telescope Array, and it's a huge array of telescopes, hundreds of dishes, each one of which is like your backyard radio dish, not the new little dish networks one, but the bigger ones that people used to have. Each one is like one of those, but there's an array of hundreds of them. And if you point them all in the same direction and then you combine the signals together, it's like having one supermassive radio telescope. And what's neat about this array is that it's being built as a dedicated instrument just to do SETI with, whereas most other SETI searches are using other telescopes that are for other kinds of experiments, and then they occasionally get to do a little bit of SETI observations. But this one has SETI as its primary goal, and it's going to come online sometime pretty soon in the next few years, and it's going to increase our ability to listen for signals by many, many orders of magnitude. So if there's a civilization out there sending us messages, and we haven't detected it yet just because our equipment hasn't been quite powerful enough, then when this telescope comes online, we'll hear from them. So there's going to be a new possibility within just the next few years to hear a message that we haven't heard yet.
Do you know the message will be, change our name from Gliese to something cool?
Yeah, maybe. They might be kind of insulted that we're just giving them numbers. It's like
that's what we should do. We should have
the prisoner.
Let's have a contest. Well, let's open.
I'm not a number. I'm an alien.
Yeah, we have prizes and stuff because we're a radio show. So if anyone wants to call in right now and suggest a better name for this planet than C581,
that's the worst name in the world.
That's stupid. What if you were born and your mom named you C581?
That's the worst name in a hit. You guys could not have picked a worse name.
What if our radio show was called the Chris and C581 Late Night Talk Show? That'd be stupid.
Yeah.
People wouldn't listen.
True. You almost can't think of a worse name.
No, so let's open up the phone lines, and if anybody has a better name for the first potentially habitable planet besides our own, and you want to give it a better name than C581, call the show right now. Let's tell a real-life scientist who has the power to get it named if he knows the right people. And give us a call now, 513-961-8900, and we got prizes for the best name. 961-8900, 513-961-8900.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
All right.
You guys are much better radio hosts than George Noory and what's his name?
Bell isn't too bad, but, you know, he could find a better fill-in than that damn George Noory. That guy is like watching a brick.
Well, didn't Art Bell, get really paranoid and disappear because he thought people were trying to off him?
Yeah, he does that all the time. And that's just him and his cult of personality and his late-night vibe. And that's fine. Someday when I got that late-night vibe, I'm going to do the same thing.
I think it's called retirement is what that's
called. But that Noory is the most boring thing I've ever heard on radio. I'd rather listen to the static. No, really, I'm serious. You get out the old short wave and you start flipping around the different statics, you know, and that's more interesting than listening to George Noory. Or those counting stations. You ever hear those counting stations on the short wave?
Oh, with like the where somebody's just counting in different languages?
Yeah, it's got something to do with, the CIA.
Yeah, well, they do have good commercial breaks.
That's about all I got. David Grinspoon, thanks as always for being on the show yet again, and we will have you on again soon.
Don't forget to buy gold.
Yeah, buy some gold.
Okay, well, thanks, guys. It's always a pleasure.
All right, well, stay in touch, and I'll talk to you again soon.
All right, take care.